Okay, if you have not already, grab your Bibles and go to the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. And we have a lot of ground that we need to cover in this book today. We're going to cover two chapters in chapters 5 and 6. And so we've got about 10 classes to cover 12 chapters. So there's a couple times we're going to have to double up in order to do that. And this is a good place to do it. If you remember from our first study, from our first class on the book of Daniel, you got 12 chapters in this book, and they nicely divide right in half. It's nice when a book does that. The first six chapters are really the chapters we're more familiar with. We know the story about Daniel and what he would eat or not eat in chapter 1. We know the dream of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2. We definitely know Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in chapter 3. We know that dream in chapter 4 we looked at last week of the tree. We know about Belshazzar and the handwriting on the wall. We know about the lion's den in chapter 6. We know the first six chapters. Last six chapters, not so much. And the reason is those first six chapters are historical, about events in the life of Daniel, and they're great stories that we're able to tell children at home and in Bible classes. But those last six chapters are prophetic. Those last six chapters are about some amazing visions that God allowed Daniel to see. And some just amazing, detailed prophecies that Daniel made hundreds of years before they happened. And there, in that section, there's what we call apocalyptic language, which is just talking about there are some symbolic language. There's some things that are perhaps difficult for us to understand. And so we haven't studied those chapters as much. And so we'll be getting into chapter 7 and that second half of the book next week. But I want us to look in chapters 5 and 6 today and to be reminded of just the historical setting of the book of Daniel. In 606 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Judah and besieged the city of Jerusalem in 606 B.C., carried away those first wave of captives into Babylon, and Daniel and his three friends, among other nobles and other members of the royal family, were carried away captive in 606 B.C., and then Nebuchadnezzar came back in 597 B.C., took the second wave of captives to Babylon. That would have included Ezekiel and others. And then finally conquered the city and the nation, destroyed the temple in 586 B.C. But 606 is our time marker for the beginning of the book of Daniel. And it's the time when Daniel is carried away and the beginning of Babylonian captivity. How long were God's people going to be in captivity? 70 years. Jeremiah told them that. Jeremiah told the captives that before they ever went. When he was pleading with them to make changes in their lives, he says, you're going to go and you're going to be captives for 70 years. Well, Daniel lived that entire time. He was there from the beginning, and he was there all the way to the end and through and past the end of that 70 years. What we're seeing in Daniel chapter 5 today, and then in Daniel chapter 6, is we're seeing a transition of power. At the end, the chapter 5 is the end of Babylon. And in fact, as we look at various dates, we've talked about 606 being the beginning of that Babylonian time of going into captivity. When you get to chapter 5, the year is 539 B.C. They have been in Babylon for 67 years. And you say, well, it's supposed to be 70. Well, you've got them in captivity for three more years until the decree of Cyrus that we read about in Ezra chapter 1. But this is 67 years after Daniel is taken captive into Babylon. In fact, for Daniel chapter 5, we know the exact day on which all of this transpired. It was October the 12th, 539 B.C. We only know the exact day because we know when Babylon fell. From historical records, we know when Babylon fell to the Medes, and that's what Daniel chapter 5 is about. It is about the fall of Babylon to the Medes, and this is the last day. This is the last day of Babylon being in power. So when you get to chapter 5, we're introduced to a new character. His name is Belshazzar, and he's now the king. He's believed to be the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And so you had Nebuchadnezzar for those first four chapters of the book of Daniel. You get to chapter 5, and now Belshazzar is the king, likely his grandson. Just a reminder that the book of Daniel is not necessarily chronological, meaning when we get to the last six chapters of the book, it's not that you go from chapter 6 and then you go into chapter 7, and chapter 7 happens after chapter 6. Go to chapter 7 really quick. Y'all got to be quick. You got to listen quick today. You got to turn quick. We got a lot of ground. But look in chapter 7 and verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Well, guess what we're reading in Daniel chapter 5? We're reading the last day of his life. The last day of his reign. Chapter 7 is a rewind into the first year, a prophecy that took place in the first year. Look in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 1. And it's the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. So chapter 7 and 8 are prophecies, are visions that Daniel received, but they happened earlier in chronology of the book anyway, and they happened before we get to chapter 5. So come back to chapter 5. We're reading about Belshazzar. Remember that Bel is another name for Marduk, which was the primary god of the Babylonians. And so his name is based upon a Babylonian god. And his name simply means Bel, protect the king. Or that Babylonian king, that Babylonian god was to protect the king. But he throws a great feast here. And he invites all of the great lords. And this is a major feast. And they are getting, they are enjoying wine. They are drinking wine. They are just having a good time. What's interesting is at this very moment, the Persian army is surrounded, has surrounded Babylon. They are besieged by the Persian army, and yet they're having a great feast. And some people have tried to figure out, why are they having a great feast when they're about ready to be killed? And there's a number of different ideas that have come out about why that they're doing this. Some have said, well, it was an annual feast and they always did this, that it was a state banquet and that they were honoring their gods as a part of this. Some have thought, well, maybe they were hoping that their gods would come and help them to fight back against the Persians. But he's throwing a great feast. But what does he do? Verse 2, while he's drinking this wine, he gives a command. And the command is in verse 2 to go and get the gold and the silver vessels that had come from where? That had come from the temple in Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar had conquered and destroyed the temple in 586 B.C. and in 606 B.C. and in all of those years that transpired, he was bringing back, and that was custom, he was bringing back as the spoils of war many of the gold and silver vessels, the drinking vessels from Jerusalem and brought them back to Babylon. But as custom would be, they were generally treated with respect. That's just what you did when you brought those kind of things back. But, well, Belshazzar is not interested in treating them with respect. And so he brings these vessels that were in the house of God, verse 3 says, and he brings them to this drunken feast. And in verse 4, it says, they drank wine, and while they're drinking wine in their drunken feast, they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, and wood and stone. That makes sense, right? So here's these vessels that were used in Jerusalem to praise the God of heaven, and now they're being used to praise the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, and wood and stone. That makes a whole lot of sense. So here they are taking that which is God's and using it to praise idols. You think God was paying attention to what's happening here? Well, yeah, God's paying attention. So in verse 5, this is one of the most amazing things that happens in Scripture. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote. I want you to get this picture. You got a man's hand that appears and begins writing opposite the lampstand. So there's light for this to be seen. It's on the plaster wall of the king's palace. By the way, when there was an archaeological expedition at this very same spot, they found the king's palace and found a room that had plaster walls in it. So God puts this in the Bible for a reason. So the king saw, the end of verse 5, he saw the part of the hand that wrote. And his countenance, verse 6 says, his countenance changed. Literally, his color changed. Would yours? If you saw a man's hand writing on the wall, would your color change? Would you grow pale? And I love verse 6. His thoughts troubled, his thoughts terrorized him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. You think that was really happening? That's what would really be happening to you. You'd be terrified. This man was so here's the most powerful man in the world, at least what he thinks is the most powerful man in the world at this time. And he sees this happening and he is scared to death. So he cries aloud to bring in. Does this sound familiar? Does this sound like his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar? To bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And he said to the wise men of Babylon. Haven't they learned by now that these guys are really not wise men? I mean, haven't they figured out that these guys really don't know what they're doing? He said to the wise men, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, does he have the power to do that? What does it mean by third ruler? Well, Belshazzar is the king, as we see in verse 1, but he's actually a co-regent. He is reigning at the same time with his father. And we don't read about his father in this text because generally his father was known to take a long leaves of absence away from Babylon and go on some religious pilgrimages. And so Nabonidus was his name. That's his father's name. So Nabonidus was actually the king of Babylon, but he wasn't there. And so his son, Belshazzar, is co-reigning with him. So you've got Nabonidus, who's the first ruler. You've got Belshazzar, who's really the second ruler. And so Belshazzar is saying, if somebody can tell me what the meaning of this is, I'm going to make him the third ruler. You got my dad, you got me. You'll be the third most powerful man in this land. And so what do the wise men do? Verse 8, all of the king's unwise men came. Could they read it? Nope. Could they tell him what it meant? Nope. And so when they couldn't tell him what was going on, what does verse 9 say? He's even more troubled. He's freaking out even more. His countenance changes again. And his lords, the end of verse 9 says, his lords were astonished. They see his reaction and they're concerned about it. So I want you to get the picture. They're having this drunken feast. They don't know it, but it's their last night to be alive. It's their last night to be in power. This hand comes and writes on the wall. It's got their attention. They don't know what it says. They don't know what it means. So the queen comes along. This is not his wife. It's likely his mother comes along and tells him, you know what? Verse 11, there is a man in your kingdom. Think about this woman and what she knows, what she has seen. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God, or your Bible might say, in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, your forefather Nebuchadnezzar, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in this man. And so King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, your forefather, the father, your father, the king, he made him chief of the magicians. Remember that back in chapter 2? Verse 11, inasmuch, think about this. What does she say about Daniel in verse 12? Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and the New King James says explaining enigmas, explaining difficult problems, were found in this Daniel. What did she remember about this guy? She remembered everything about him. She remembered the power, the knowledge, the abilities that he has. Notice she calls him by his Hebrew name. In this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. How does she still know his Hebrew name? Wouldn't everybody be calling him Belteshazzar? He had made a name for himself. He was respected in the Babylonian empire to the point that, yes, he was called Belteshazzar, but his Hebrew name was still known. And so she says, you need to call for this man Daniel. Now think about this. This is 539 B.C. He was taken captive in 606 B.C. when he was 15, 16, 17 years of age. He's been there for 67 years. How old is Daniel? He's kind of an old critter, sorry. But he is in his 80s. He's in his early 80s by this point. And yet, God is still going to use this man. And so the king calls for Daniel in verse 13. And the king says to Daniel in verse 13, are you that Daniel, Hebrew name, And sometimes we don't think about it being his Hebrew name as we, because that's what we call him, but that's not what they knew him to be. Are you not that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah? Isn't that interesting? It had been 67 years since he had come from Judah. And what's still known about him? Oh, you're one of those slaves. You're one of those servants that we brought back here 67 years ago. That stuck with him. Are you not that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? And I've heard that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. And so he tells him in verse 15, my wise men, they are not wise. They could not help me. Verse 16, I have heard that you can give the interpretation and that you can explain the enigmas, that you can solve difficult problems. And so he makes the promise directly to Daniel in verse 16. If you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple, have a chain of gold around your neck, and you, Daniel, shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Same promise. I'm going to give this to you. The king is so troubled by what he sees, he's going to make any promise that he can to find out what he means. Do you think he realized that something was going on that had to do with him? Nebuchadnezzar knew there was something about that dream in chapter 2 that had to do with him. Nebuchadnezzar knew there was something about that dream in chapter 4 that had to do with him. Do you think that Belshazzar is wise enough, even in his drunken state, to realize something's going on here? I mean, if you were there and a hand appeared and wrote something on a wall in your house, would you think, somebody's trying to give me a message? I don't know what that message is, but somebody's trying to give me a message. And that's Belshazzar. And so he says to Daniel, I need you to tell me what's going on. And so Daniel begins his conversation, begins his explanation to the king in verse 17. And really in the first part of this, he rebukes the king. And he says to him, let your gifts be to yourself and give your rewards to another. I want you to think about it. What good was it going to be for Daniel to be made third ruler of Babylon on the last night that Babylon was going to exist? Yay, I'm third ruler for 2 minutes. What kind of reward is that? He's like, you know what, keep your gifts to yourself. Power of God can't be bought anyway. I'm going to read the writing and I'm going to make known the interpretation. So look at what he says to him in verse 18. Does this sound familiar? O King, the Most High God. How many times have we read that already in this book, Daniel saying that to Nebuchadnezzar? Here's Babylon that has multiple gods that they believe in and multiple gods they worship. What have we already seen? They worship the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, and wood and stone. There's at least six gods right there. Daniel says, the Most High God. What did he do? He gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. Where did Nebuchadnezzar get his kingdom? From God. In fact, in chapter 2 and verse 37, you read almost those exact same words of Daniel saying that to Nebuchadnezzar, that the Most High God has given that to you. So God put Nebuchadnezzar in place. Verse 19, because of the majesty that God gave him, all peoples, nations, languages trembled and feared before him. God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your forefather, his power. Verse 20, when his heart was lifted up, we read this last week, when he became so arrogant that he thought he was all that, his spirit was hardened with his pride, and he was disposed from his kingly throne, and he goes out and he eats grass like a wild beast, like an oxen. Verse 21, and the dew of heaven fell upon him. Look at the end of verse 21. All of this happened to him until, that's a key word we saw in chapter 4, he knew, that's a key word we saw in chapter 4, all of that happened to Nebuchadnezzar till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. We saw that same expression at least four times in chapter 4. Something that Nebuchadnezzar needed to learn is that the Most High rules in all kingdoms and that God is in control. Did Nebuchadnezzar need to learn that lesson? Yeah. Did Belshazzar need to learn that lesson? Yeah. Do we need to learn that lesson? Is that still true today? Does the Most High God still exist today? Is He still rule today? Does He still rule in the kingdom of men? Yes. God is still God, and He is still the King of heaven, just as Nebuchadnezzar had called Him. Verse 22, but you, His son, Belshazzar, you haven't learned. You haven't learned from the mistakes of the past. You haven't learned from the mistakes of your ancestors. You should have learned from Nebuchadnezzar, but you've not humbled your heart. Well, you're following in the, you know, like grandfather, like grandson. You've not humbled your heart, although you knew how much of this. You knew all of this. This is not something that's, I'm not telling you something you don't know. You've already known this. And you have exalted yourself. You've lifted yourself up against who? The Lord of heaven. The Most High God who has given Nebuchadnezzar His kingdom and given you your kingdom. You've exalted yourself against Him. And you've brought the vessels from His house, those gold and silver vessels. And here you are getting drunk with them and praising the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. What does Daniel say about those gods, about those idols? They do not see, they do not hear, and they do not know. Isn't that interesting how people will worship things that do not see, do not hear, and do not know? Do we still do that today? Oh no, I don't do that today. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5 says, covetousness is idolatry. Do we sometimes serve something that doesn't see and doesn't hear and doesn't know? Daniel says, that's what you're doing. And the God, this is an interesting way to say it in verse 23, the God who holds your breath in His hand. Think about that. Does God, that's not a threat. He's not threatening him that He's going to cut off his breath. He's saying, God holds your breath in His hand. Paul would say to the idolatrous Athenians, in Acts chapter 17, that God gives to all life, breath, and all things. Where does man get his breath? From God, and that's all that Daniel's saying to him. You're serving these stupid idols, and the God who gives you breath, and He owns all of your ways, verse 23 says, you haven't even glorified Him. So here's what he says, verse 24. Let me tell you about the fingers of the hand. Here's interesting, verse 24. The fingers of the hand were sent from Him. This is a message that has come from the God of heaven. What's the message? Verse 25. This is the inscription that was written. And these are not words that we understand. They should have been words that the Babylonians would have at least recognized. The Babylonians were known for their expertise with numbers. And that's what these words are all about. God uses terms that would have been their Aramaic terms, again, that they would have understood, but they had to do with weights and measures. And so the message on the wall is, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. You ever taught that to little children in Bible class? That's fun. Teach that to little kids in Bible class. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. You ever had a coloring page that you give to the children? I've seen these coloring pages the children have, and you got this hand writing that on the wall. So Daniel says, this is what it says. Okay, yes, that's what it says. What does it mean? This is the interpretation of each word. Mene. The word mene simply means numbered. That's what the word means, is numbered. And so Daniel says, God has numbered your kingdom and has finished it. God has counted out the number of days that your kingdom is to exist. And guess what? We've got to the end of that number. God's been counting down. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Oop, you're done. God's numbered it, and He's numbered it twice. Numbered, numbered, you're done. Well, what's the rest of this? Verse 27. What does tekel mean? He's numbered it. He's not only numbered it, and he's counted down the number of days. He has weighed it. He's put it on the balance. And He has weighed out your kingdom to see, okay, how does this balance out? You have been weighed in the balances, not just in the balances that you're going to find in the marketplace, but in the balances and the scales of divine justice, and you have been found wanting. You are light, You are inadequate. You do not measure up to God's divine standards. Verse 28, Perez is just the singular form of the plural eupharsin, and that word simply means divided. So you've been numbered, your numbers are done. You've been weighed, you haven't been found sufficient. And so your kingdom, verse 28, has been divided. And it's been divided to be given to two nations that became one in their power, given to the Medes and the Persians. The Medes were ruled temporarily in comparison to the Persians, who were that dominant force that came on the scene. And so verse 29, after Belshazzar hears the interpretation, he gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with, we've read this twice already in this chapter, they clothed Daniel with purple and a chain of gold around his neck. They made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. How long did that last? Well, not very long, because the next verse says that very night. Perhaps, one, Belshazzar's keeping his word, but perhaps maybe he's hoping that this might mitigate the coming judgment, and maybe he would appease the God of heaven by making his prophet third in the nation, and maybe these horrible things won't happen. But verse 30 says these horrible things happened. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. End of his reign, October the 12th, 539 B.C., and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Sometime you ought to go and read something about the fall of Babylon and read about how this transpired. They no doubt thought, they knew that the Persians were out there, that they were surrounded, but they thought that they were impregnable. They thought the city was impregnable. You read about the walls of Babylon and how thick that they were. And you think about their arrogance already. But the Euphrates River ran right under the walls of the city, so they had water supply. They had food that would last them for months and months and months. They thought, who cares who's out there? We're in here and everything's okay. Well, those of you who've read about it, what did they do to the Euphrates River? Oh, well, we'll just get rid of that. And they rerouted. Can you imagine? They're in a drunken feast, and while that's happening, the river is being rerouted, this river that runs under the city walls, and so now they've got a clear path to come in where the river used to be, right underneath the walls, into the city to take them, just as it had been prophesied, without battle. They did not battle them to overcome them. They came right inside their city and killed them. Without any kind of fight or battle. One, because they caught them by surprise. Two, because they were drunk in the city. And here was God taking down this nation and bringing up another one, because the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men. And now there's this man named Darius the Mede. We don't know, historically, we don't know a lot about Darius. Some have tried to figure out, who is this guy? Some have looked at him and say, well, maybe he's a son of Cyrus. And so that's why sometimes their names are often found together. Some have thought maybe Darius was one of Cyrus's generals, and that he had been sent out to conquer this land. And so after conquering Babylon, he was able to rule over Babylon for a period of time. Some have even thought that maybe Darius and Cyrus, maybe they were the same person. And just by a different name. Any of those three are I think, possibilities for us. But we read about this Darius, and I know we're moving quick, but get into chapter 6. We got 15 minutes to cover this good chapter. You get into chapter 6, and we're reading about Darius. Something that's interesting for you is that if you go back into some old texts of Scripture, verse 31 of chapter 5, for some, was actually the first chapter of the following chapter. Remember, chapters and verses, they weren't put into the Bible until thousands of years after they were written. And so, really, verse 31 fits with chapter 6, at least as a very lead-in, that Darius the Mede receives the kingdom. And when Darius becomes king and conquers Babylon, verse 1 says that it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps. These are officials that would have great rule. Obviously, they would be over the whole kingdom, verse 1 says. Think about, here's a nation like Persia who's coming and conquering lands. Well, you've got to have some sort of government. You've got to have somebody to rule over these new nations, these new lands that you've conquered. And so he sets up 120 satraps and likely even pulls from some of the existing governing officials from Babylon in order to be in that place. And so we see that in verse 2. Over these 120 satraps, three governors or administrators were set up, of whom Daniel was one. Think about this. Here's a man in his early 80s, and he's chosen right away. Why would he be chosen by Darius? Well, providence of God for sure, but no doubt he was spoken highly of by the Babylonians. But Daniel was set up in order that the satraps might give account to these people, in order that the king would suffer no loss, so that he didn't lose any tax money that was being collected. These three governors were to oversee everything. I know that you know the story of Daniel in the lion's den. It is one of the best stories in all of the Bible. It's one of the best stories in all of recorded literature. To read about this awesome event of Daniel, an 80-something-year-old man being thrown into a lion's den. But why did that happen? Why is he thrown into a lion's den? You've got 120 satraps and three governors over them. These three governors, made up of Daniel and these two other critters, what did these two other critters think about Daniel? Oh, they're jealous. They are envious of this guy. And so verse 3 says that Daniel distinguished himself. How did he do that? Did he do that out of arrogance and pride? Did he do that out of force? Is it possible for us to distinguish ourselves from others just by the way that we live? By doing what's right? By the way that we talk? Can we set ourselves apart? Not that we're arrogant, not that we're better than... Daniel wasn't setting himself apart to say, I'm better than somebody else. He distinguished himself by the way that he lived, even in these early days. And I don't know how far chapter 6 is into the reign of Darius. When we get to chapter 10, there's a time marker. In chapter 10, the time marker is the third year of Cyrus. This is at least a couple, 3 years into the Medo-Persian Empire. And I say that partly because there was a relationship that had been developed between Daniel and Darius. Did Darius want to throw Daniel into the lion's den? No. He did not want to do that because there was a bond that, how did that bond come about? Because Daniel was a man of integrity. And this man of integrity had been respected by and acknowledged by the king to set him up as one of his three governors. They had developed some kind of relationship, and that doesn't just happen in a couple days. So this is sometime after, at least a couple years, I would think, into the reign of the Medes and the Persians. But verse 3 says that Daniel distinguished himself above these other men because an excellent spirit was in him. And so the king was planning to set him over the whole realm. He was planning it, not just, okay, you're one of the three governors. You know what? I'm going to elevate you. I'm going to promote you to be over the whole realm. Well, what do the other guys think of that? All right, Daniel, you're great. We support that. Is that what they thought? No. Look at this skunk. Look at this guy from Judah. We're not going to let this happen. So verse 4 says, they sought some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. That was their first effort. Let's see if we can find him doing something. Maybe he's skimming a little off of the top. Maybe he's pulling a little under the table. Isn't it interesting that we use expressions about off the top and under the table to mean almost the same thing? But maybe he's doing something to take some of this, to catch some money, cheat the king in some way, but they couldn't find anything, verse 4 says, because he was what? Faithful. Was Daniel perfect? That's not what that verse says. What was Daniel? He was faithful. Faithful to who? Well, faithful to the king. Who else was he faithful to? He's faithful to God. And so these men said, all right, this isn't going to work. He's faithful to the king. He's not going to do anything against the king. So verse 5 says, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of, not the Medes and the Persians, concerning the law of his God. We've got to figure out a way for his devotion to his God to come in conflict with his devotion to the Medes and the Persians. And so they figured it out. Verse 6. These governors and satraps, they thronged before the king. Get this picture. Here are these men. They are coming and they are crowding in the midst of the king. And they said to him, King Darius, live forever. Verse 7. Has anybody ever come to you? Has anybody ever come to you? You know, people do this to the elders a lot. Has anybody ever come to you and said, you know what? Everybody's saying this. Anybody ever done that? You know, everybody thinks this. Anybody ever said that to you? You know, all the people are telling me. Anybody ever said that to you? What, Chuck?
Name two.
Happens all the time, doesn't it? Why do people do that? Because they want the person they're talking to or the persons they're talking to think, oh, there's a lot of weight behind what I'm saying. So what do they say to the king in verse 7? All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators, the satraps, counselors, and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, of course, shall be cast into the den of lions. The first word of verse 7 is the word all. Is that a true statement? All of the governors had consulted together? We know at least one that was not included in that consultation, and his name's Daniel. So here's a group of people. Oh, everybody's saying this, king. No, not everybody. They misrepresented the situation to the king. Did he know that? Nope, didn't know that. He got taken for a ride. And he said, okay, verse 8, now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. And so King Darius signed the written decree. There were a number of things. Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4 is a verse that says, when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman. When the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his son. What does that mean? Jesus came in that first century. Jesus came at the perfect time for Jesus to come. God had been orchestrating events to bring about a perfect time for Jesus to come. And if we had time, we would talk about how all of these nations, the Babylonians, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks and the Romans, all four nations that were seen in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, all four of them put things into place that were in the world when Jesus came. The Romans put in a road system. And the Romans, there was a peace that existed in that first century. Guess what? Perfect time for Jesus to come. The Greeks provided a universal language, the Greek language, that was spoken all over. Perfect time for Jesus to come. Medes and the Persians were a group of people that were devoted to law. They were devoted to law and order. And so if there was a law that was in place, that law could not be changed. Is that a good time for Jesus to come? When there is at least a general respect for law. That when a law is put in place, that's the law that we are to follow. We're not to change that law. That's the thing that the Medes and Persians gave to the world in that sense of devotion to law. And so here's that's the situation here. The situation is, they fooled Darius into signing a decree which could not be changed under the law of the Medes and Persians. You can't change a law. And that law was, for 30 days, no one can petition or pray to any god except for the king. Well, obviously, what did they know? Had these guys been on some reconnaissance missions already? Had they been scouting out Daniel to try to figure out how can we trip this guy up? Yeah, they knew exactly. They knew exactly what Daniel was going to do. Verse 10 says, when Daniel, what's the word you have after the word Daniel? Now when Daniel, what's the verb? I've got the word knew. He knew that the writing was signed. He knew that happened. He went home. What did he do? In his upper room, he did the same thing he did every other day. The end of verse 10 says this was his custom since his early days. He opened the windows toward Jerusalem. Why would you do that? Well, go back and read 1 Kings chapter 8 when Solomon dedicated the temple. And Solomon said in the dedication of the temple, when these people are taken to a foreign land and into the land of their enemies because they turn against you, and when they pray toward your city, when they pray toward Jerusalem. That's what Daniel's doing. He's just doing what Solomon said to do in 1 Kings chapter 8. Knelt down on his knees three times that day, prayed, and what else? He gave thanks. Is he complaining to God? No. He's just praying and thanking God that he has an opportunity to serve his God. And so verse 11 says, these men assembled. They found Daniel praying. These spies, you know, these are peeping Toms. They assembled. They found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. They wanted, verse 5, to find something that they could get him concerning the law of his God. And that's where he goes. He is praying before his God. Verse 12, they went before the king, spoke to him and said, haven't you signed this? Oh, king, you know, it was just earlier today. Correct us if we're wrong, king, but didn't you sign a decree that nobody was to petition? And it hasn't even been 30 hours, let alone 30 days. It's the same day. And the king says, of course I did. The end of verse 12, the thing that you say is true and it shall not be altered. And so then verse 13, they nail him. That Daniel, oh no, imagine the king hearing that. Oh great, what's happened now? Hebrew name Daniel. That Daniel, who is one of the captives, 67 years since he came, but that's what he's still called. One of the captives from Judah, does not show you, O king, due regard, or for the decree that you sign, but he makes his petition three times a day. What was the king's response when he heard that? Oh goody. Oh, goody, we get to throw somebody in the lion's den. We're going to have entertainment tonight. This is going to be great. Is that his reaction? No, verse 14. The king was greatly displeased with who? Himself. I got snookered. Oh, man, I got taken. I'm forgetting to put all of this up here. Let's put the rest of this up here so I don't forget the rest of it. I've gotten taken. He was displeased with himself. He set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored all day long to figure out a way to get him out of it. But what? The law had been signed, and the law could not be changed. Verse 16, the king gave the command. I want you to see that word. Cast Daniel into the pit, but before he's cast in there, he says to Daniel, your God, Daniel, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. And so they put a stone over the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his ring, saying, don't anybody touch this stone, in order that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Verse 18, king went to his palace. And in verse 18, instead of us reading, we don't read about the bad night that Daniel had, do we? We read about the bad night that the king had. Daniel's fine. He's an 80-year-old man. He's probably asleep in there with the lions, right? But here is the king, and in his palace, three things. He spent the night fasting, no musicians, he didn't turn the television on. He didn't have any kind of enjoyment or entertainment that night, and his sleep left him. He could not sleep. He arose before daybreak. He arose very early in the morning, verse 19, went in haste to the den of lions, and he shouted out to Daniel before he even got there, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel says, O king, live forever. My God sent the angel. He shut the lion's mouth, and God has delivered me. Verse 23, the king gave the command. He commanded Daniel to be thrown in. Verse 23, he gave the command to get Daniel out of there. And verse 24, he gave the command to throw those no good guys who had made those accusations against him, throw them in there where the lions just weren't hungry, right? They were just not hungry during the night. No, were these lions hungry? How hungry were they? Before those no good accusers even reached the bottom of the den, lions had their breakfast. The lions broke their fast and they ate and enjoyed their feast. Verse 25, very quickly. Here's the decree of Cyrus, or the decree of Darius. Verse 26, I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one that will not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. Think about a pagan deity, a pagan king saying this. Verse 27, he delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders. Did he know that? Yeah. And he's delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, the reign of Cyrus the Persian. What an amazing account of a man named Daniel who was serving under the most powerful nation of Babylon in the court of the most powerful man of Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, and now he's serving in the most powerful nation of the Medes and Persians in the king of that great nation. Is God at work? Yes, and that's the whole point of the book of Daniel. God is at work. God is in charge, and God rules. I know that was a quick look. Thank you all very much for your good attention this morning.